From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The National Security Council is expected to meet this week to discuss the American military campaign against ISIS in Syria. And there could be major changes coming. Last week, President Trump said U.S. troops would be leaving Syria very soon. Senator Lindsey Graham responded to that on Fox News Sunday.
It'd be the single worst decision the president could make. We got ISIL on the ropes. You don't want to let them off the ropes. Remove American soldiers.
Let's bring in Richard Engel. He hosts On Assignment with Richard Engel on MSNBC, and he's just returned from a reporting trip inside Syria. He's on a Skype line. Richard, welcome.
Well, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
You spoke to senior U.S. military commanders at a secret base in Kobani, Syria, and they told you they're concerned about what they're hearing from the Trump administration. Is that right?
They are concerned about the general direction of the war on ISIS, and they are concerned about what they're hearing from the White House. They are concerned about what they're not hearing from the White House. If you don't mind, can I just set the table sort of?
Please.
For 4 years, there have been a limited number of American special forces operating in Syria.
And about 2,000 of them, right, Richard?
Now there are about 2,000 of them, and it started with a group of like 50. They've been building up their footprint, but still, 2,000 is a relatively small footprint. Most of the ground fighting, actually all of the ground fighting, is done by this Kurdish-led coalition, which is called the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces. And it's a big force. This is not just a little militia. We're talking 60,000 people that have been mentored, trained, partnered with these now 2,000 special forces. And they have been wildly successful. They have pushed ISIS back. They have ISIS, if you remember, used to hold, or the Islamic State used to hold a state-like territory that was a big black blob on a map. And now it is just two postage-sized stamps on the same map. So the commanders will say to me, "We are almost there. We are so close we can fall into the end zone. We're on the 1-2 yard line. We're right at the end." But here's a problem. If the U.S. pulls out prematurely without a plan in a sort of pull up the stakes and go, you don't cross that last final threshold, which is a problem. And two, these partners who we've been with are going to be left not just without a patron, but left to be potentially wiped out because they are now under attack from Turkey. So it is a very sensitive time where the U.S. can see the end zone, can smell the finish line. And if we leave prematurely, ISIS comes back. And this partner, and in some cases, these American commanders have developed close personal friendships with their Kurdish partners, will be left to fend for themselves against Turkey, which is not an adversary that they are in a position to confront.
The thing about that criticism is that it's familiar. Of course, people criticized President Obama for pulling out of Iraq too quickly, creating a power vacuum for ISIS and terrorism. And you know, this is something that President
Trump— You're absolutely
right. And that's something—
I heard that analogy many times. Go back to Afghanistan. In the first few months of the war in Afghanistan, the Taliban was driven back, Al-Qaeda was driven out, and the old regime in Afghanistan that had fostered this environment, which allowed 9/11 to sort of become a reality, was overturned. In 3 months, at a very little cost to the U.S., and it was a spectacular campaign. And now it has become the longest war in American history, and U.S. policy is still debating whether we should send a few more, a few thousand less, a few thousand more. And we're still there. And the same thing happened in Afghanistan, in Iraq, where we pulled out and then we had to jump back. And now the commanders are saying, we've seen this movie before, and it has this added level of betraying the local Kurdish partner.
But as you've pointed out, ISIS is nearly defeated in Syria. So, you know, nobody wants to be in Syria forever. And so what is the harm in the president saying that he wants to pull troops out of the country soon if the job is nearly done? I mean, there's got to be— what do the commanders want the president to do?
They want people to realize that you pull out and there's a little bit left that it could come back and spread. It's a little bit like a cancer. If you just leave the last bit in the body, it's going to come back and spread. And all the hard work you've done and all the sacrifice and all the pain and suffering and chemo that you've gone through is not going to have been effective. And they feel really broken up emotionally. They don't think it's right to be abandoning their partner to the Turks at this particular moment. So they're torn up that we leave prematurely, then we don't finish the job, and we're leaving our partners out in a lurch. And unlike the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, and look, I'm not an advocate here. I don't want these troops to stay a day longer than they have to. And there are some dangers. An American soldier was killed in Syria just a few days ago. But in relative speaking terms, it has been a fairly safe mission. In the 4 years that U.S. troops have been there, two Americans have been killed in combat, including one of them that was just killed a couple of days ago. Obviously, every loss is important, but when you talk about a military mission that has killed, they estimate, nearly 65,000 ISIS fighters, to have two American troops lost in combat, they would say that has been, when you look at military campaigns, one of the most successful partner campaigns, because that's what this is. It's a partner campaign in the annals of military history. Hmm.
That's Richard Engel. He's NBC News chief foreign correspondent, just back from a trip to Syria. Richard, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, China is retaliating against the U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum with tariffs by China on more than 120 U.S. goods, including a 25% tariff on frozen pork sent to China. This comes as U.S. ranchers are waiting to see what will happen with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. This month, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico will hold another round of negotiations around the trade deal, which President Trump has called a bad deal for the U.S. And yesterday, he tweeted that Mexico must stop the big drug and people flows, or I will stop their cash cow, NAFTA. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach talked to cattle producers in Nebraska to hear how NAFTA affects their business.
The beef industry is a border-blurring multinational business. One animal in a cattle feedlot could end up feeding people on two or three different continents.
When you process one of these animals, it doesn't go the same place. You have pieces that go everywhere.
That's Craig Uden, who co-owns Dar Feedlot near Cozad in central Nebraska, where trucks roll along cattle pens to fill troughs with feed. Uden says meat companies sell cuts of beef where they bring the best prices. Steaks and hamburger do well in the U.S., but other cuts sell better overseas.
The chuck roll, that could be destined for Asia, and the tongues maybe go to Japan.
NAFTA is part of how this works. Cattle from Mexico and Canada are imported to feedlots and packing plants in the U.S., tariff-free. From there, they become part of the beef supply parceled out on the export market.
It's a rebalancing. If they want high quality in Canada, we've got plenty of high quality extra beef that we can ship to Canada. If Mexico takes some of our lower quality product, hey, if it adds value to the bottom line of the beef producer in the United States, you bet.
If NAFTA unravels, he fears the U.S. would be saddled with more beef than Americans could eat, and he says it would be felt beyond the beef industry.
Then it presses back down to the grain markets and the hay markets and the ethanol production.
But there are some in the cattle business who believe NAFTA has done more harm than good. David Wright loads a big round bale of hay on the back of his tractor to feed the cattle on his ranch near Neely in north central Nebraska. Wright agrees with the Trump administration's efforts to reform NAFTA. His arguments sound like the recent debates over steel and solar panels. He says cheap cattle from Canada and Mexico undercut his business.
The cost of living or production in other countries is different than it is here. As long as we're one of the highest economies in the world, I don't see a lot of advantage in us trading for something that we already produce.
The value of the beef exported from the U.S. to Canada and Mexico typically outweighs what is imported. But Wright says when you add the trade of live cattle, the balance tilts the other way.
Someone tell me how that's good for the producer here who's paying the real estate taxes to keep the school open, as opposed to the guy in Canada who's really not.
Wright thinks NAFTA is a big reason there's been a steady decline in the number of ranchers and feedlots in the U.S. since the agreement began. But Craig Uden doesn't think that's because of Canada and Mexico.
If anything, they've kept us in the game.
Uden blames the cost of labor and keeping up with environmental rules, and he says Canada recently started buying large numbers of cattle from the U.S. The direction NAFTA turns under the Trump administration is not the only issue on the minds of cattle producers. Udin says he was glad the tax cuts passed, for instance. But he says NAFTA cuts straight to the bottom line of his business.
If you don't have profit in your industry, tax break doesn't do us a lot of good, okay? You know, we have to have both.
David Wright has been encouraged by economic growth and new jobs created so far under Trump. He says making free trade under NAFTA fairer would reinforce that. That could mean equalizing regulations or using tariffs to protect American workers.
And if we're sending jobs over to other countries, then what are our citizenry doing to earn a living? Because if they don't have revenue to spend on the product that I'm trying to sell, then I guess I don't have a product to sell then, you know?
He says that's what's in the balance as the Trump administration continues talks on trade. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Gerlach.
And Grant's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting project that focuses on farm and food issues. Writer Steve Almond tells very good stories. He's the author of 10 books. He hosts the Dear Sugars podcast and writes the Sweet Spot column in the New York Times with Cheryl Strayed. His new book is also very good, but it's about bad stories. In fact, that's the name of it, Bad Stories. And by bad, he means fraudulent, either by design or negligence. Stories that shape our national narrative and shape history. Stories like Donald Trump could never win the presidency. He's pure entertainment. The book is also about stories we choose to tell. James Comey announcing new Hillary Clinton emails days before the election, but not revealing an investigation into the Trump campaign ties to Russia. Or the New York Times assigning 9 reporters to tell the story of the Clinton emails before Comey closed the investigation because, as he said, he found nothing to investigate. Steve Almond joins us in the studio with more. Steve, good to see you as always.
Yes, good to see you.
And we should say you were a regular on this program before you got just too famous. And also, you are an unabashed...
Is that what happened?
Yes. All right. You are an unabashed liberal who writes with tremendous empathy for Trump voters, who had real issues about jobs, for instance, but you say heard bad stories about the truth about, let's say, steel belt jobs or wages. But start with stories and what stories mean to you and why it bothers you so when they're bad.
Well, I think stories are the basic unit of consciousness, human consciousness. They're how we construct reality. And every bad outcome is the result of a set of bad stories that we tell ourselves or we consent to. And that's what I was trying to do, take a step back from history and say, how did we arrive in such a moment? So much hatred, so much venom, and so little attempt to solve problems.
And you assign it to bad stories. And by the way, along the way, we hear from some of the best stories, actually. You quote from Moby Dick, Conrad's Heart of Darkness, The Great Gatsby, also nonfiction, Mencken, Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. So woven through your bad stories are the good, but let's take one of the bad. There are 17. One, that economic anguish caused Trumpism.
The idea is just not true. Mm. All of the social scientists who have broken it down said, look, the central determinant of why people became ardent Trump supporters was racial animus, which had to do with a sense of lost utility and, frankly, had to do with a kind of masculine insecurity.
But you do also note that there are a lot of people who are feeling economic anxiety. They're not seeing their wages rise. They're seeing their jobs leave. But the irony there is that statistics show that the majority of Trump voters were middle class and wealthy suburbanites, and they voted for the very person who's a part of the gap that they're feeling.
Right. I mean, this is why, again, if one of the bad stories that sort of explains why people vote against their interests is this American habit of exalting our grievances and ignoring our vulnerabilities. So why would somebody in middle America vote for a candidate who has pledged to get rid of their health care? Well, because they prioritize immigrants or some dark other who's going to come take their jobs, American carnage, over what really they're vulnerable about, which is they might lose their health insurance.
Okay, bad story number 6. What amuses us can't hurt us. In this, you take on media figures like Les Moonves, who was chair of CBS, who described the whole thing as a circus, but said it was good for CBS because it was entertaining. And you say Jon Stewart did tremendous damage. His bad story was making Donald Trump a punchline. Here he is with Stephen Colbert after Trump became the Republican nominee.
The guy from The Apprentice?
Yep.
The guy who did a McDonald's commercial with the grimace.
Same guy.
The guy who filed for bankruptcy in 1991.
And 92.
And 2004.
And 2009.
That guy.
Yes.
You know, he was an oracle for so many, but you said, no, he fell into the same bad story. Explain.
Part of what's happened in American culture is that we have become unserious. We're incapable of having a serious discussion about our common crises and how to solve them. And we also see increasing civic dysfunction. I think on the right, the tendency is to get focused on conspiracy theories and paranoia. On the left, I think the problem is that we're frightened of our dysfunction. We feel helpless before it. And our response is to convert our feelings of anguish and distress into disposable laughs. Actually, that's what Stewart does and Colbert and the rest of them. And Robin, they're brilliant at it. And I get that they're just comedians. But the message that they're sending is that it's okay if government's totally broken and your elected leaders are bought and paid for. They're all losers. They're all hypocrites. And your best response is to laugh at it. I know that sounds like a real bummer, but that's the line that Trump was using at every rally, was that all our systems are broken. The system is rigged against you. Jon Stewart was laying the groundwork for Trumpism, and that's not a dig on him as a comedian.
Yeah, because I'm sure from their point of view, they're thinking, we're using comedy, but you know, as I was reading your writing, it did relegate it to just entertainment.
That's right. It trivializes it. And there are certain things that we should be feeling, a sense of despair and outrage. We should be deeply upset that we are not taking seriously the species-wide threat, the threat to the planet that's posed by climate change. We should be furious that a country as abundant and wealthy as ours can't care for our most vulnerable citizens.
Oh, Steve, you're such a bummer.
I know.
Okay, bad story number 8. And this involves President Obama. Bad story number 8 is nobody will vote for a guy like this. And you cite several instances in which President Obama mocks Donald Trump, the candidate. Now, this was usually in response to mean and belittling things Trump had said about Obama, you know, that Obama wasn't born in America. Or in this case on Jimmy Kimmel in October, just before the election, President Obama reacted to candidate Trump's tweets.
President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States! Exclamation point. At real Donald Trump. Well, at real Donald Trump, at least I will go down as a president.
But your point seems to be, if you're telling people no one will vote for this person,
yeah,
then those very people are taking in, well, then I don't have to get involved because there's really not an election going on.
This election was decided by 0.077% of those who did not vote. Okay, the number of people, 103 million who didn't vote. The election was decided by 79,000 votes over 3 swing states, okay? So even if he convinced 0.077% of voters not to get up and schlep to the polls on a Tuesday in November, if they feel like it doesn't really matter because the president is already joking about the election, that really carries weight with them. And they might decide, you know, I got better things to do. She's probably going to win anyway. I'm not going to worry about it.
Look, Steve Almond, you know that the Trump voter is listening to you and saying, oh, my gosh, you are reaching to try to explain why Donald Trump won the election. Bottom line, he won the election. You know, that this is just sour grapes or a desperate attempt to parse
it. Well, of course. But I don't see the book as being about Donald Trump winning the election. I think that's the instigation for the book. But the book is trying to say, how could somebody like this become a serious candidate in America? What are the bad stories that we've been constructing?
Look, you talk about Putin attacking the U.S. with bad stories. You write about Cambridge Analytica before it was in the news.
Yeah.
And the way they filtered stories. But what I'd like to do is end on one of the good stories that you reference.
Yes, there are some. Please mention that. Yes.
And it's a passage from Grapes of Wrath. And it's an experience that you had after appearing on this program,
yes,
I think, to talk about Grapes of Wrath. I know you're going to be reading a passage. I just won't let people know it's very sensitive for those who, you know, maybe not prepared for it at this moment. But it's just beautiful as well. So could you read about getting those emails after talking about John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, of course, the story of the starving Jode family driven by the Depression and the Dust Bowl from Oklahoma to California?
I received a few responses to the segment, but the one I remember most vividly came from a man who insisted that, while he understood the book was a classic, its final scene had always disgusted him. The book ends, of course, with the Joe daughter, Rose of Sharon, giving birth to a stillborn child in a barn where she has sought shelter from a storm. Also in the barn is an emaciated stranger. The final lines read, "Then slowly she lay down beside him. He shook his head from side to side. Rose of Sharon loosened one side of the blanket and bared her breast. 'You got to,' she said. She squirmed closer and pulled his head close. 'There,' she said. 'There.' Her hand moved behind his head and supported it. Her finger moved gently in his hair. She looked up and across the barn, and her lips came together and smiled mysteriously." What was she doing smiling? My correspondent wanted to know. Wasn't it creepy enough that she was breastfeeding a grown man? I wanted to tell him he was missing the point of the story. The point of the story was that the man was starving to death. The point of the story was that she was saving his life.
I gotta recover.
Yeah. It's so sad to me. That's one of the most humane pieces of writing that we have, this beautiful story that this, you know, genius crafted to try to say, you have to try to help people who are struggling. You have to try to save people's lives. And I don't want to be too critical of this listener. I appreciate any feedback I get, but he was just missing the point. Mm.
I can hear and see how this is affecting you even now.
Yeah. I get shaken up by this because I think there are a lot of people walking around these days who are trying to make sense of this moment we're in. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that we become empowered is by telling better stories, more compassionate, more merciful stories. And that requires sometimes looking at the bad stories that are sort of all around us like a trace element.
Steve Almond, his new book is Bad Stories. Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Teachers in Kentucky and Oklahoma are rallying at their state capitals today. In Kentucky, they're protesting in Frankfort as lawmakers consider a new budget deal. And the teachers were there protesting on Friday, too, after a plan to overhaul the pension system was rushed through the legislature. Joining us now is Rylan Barton. He's state capitol reporter for the Kentucky Public Radio Network. And Rylan, what's the scene at the capitol today? How many teachers have turned out?
There are thousands of teachers here. This week is spring break for most Kentucky schools, and the handful of schools that were still open decided to close as well in anticipation of all these teachers descending on Frankfort today, partly in reaction to this overhaul of the pension system that lawmakers passed really quickly last week.
Yeah, so tell us more what's at stake. As you say, there's this pension system that teachers are concerned about, but they're also at the Capitol because lawmakers have to pass a new budget today. Are those two issues related?
Yeah, they're partly related. Kentucky has one of the worst funded pension systems in the nation. And so to try and address that, the Republican-led legislature passed this bill that tweaks benefits mostly for current employees. So one of the big things that teachers are upset with is that future teachers would no longer receive a conventional pension. They'd be moved into what's called a cash balance retirement plan. It also tweaks benefits to current teachers. It changes how they can use sick time to qualify for retirement or to get better retirement benefits. Also, lawmakers have to pass a new state budget. This is the last day they can do that in order to pass a bill and still be able to have a chance to override any vetoes the governor makes to it. They just revealed a new budget this morning, and they also revealed this new tax reform plan at the last minute that nobody really knows much about so far. So we're kind of sifting through all the details at the moment.
Will the changes that the lawmakers want to make to this pension system actually help get the state out of that huge hole it's in?
Actually, so one of the estimates is that these changes would save the state about $300 million over the next 30 years.
Wow.
So that's about $10 million a year.
Dropping the bucket.
Meanwhile, the state's pension debt is about $41 billion over the next 30 years. So it's really a small amount compared to the overall pension debt.
How much are these teachers looking towards other states? You know, there have been rallies in Arizona. There's a rally in Oklahoma today. We know that in West Virginia, they went on a 9-day strike for a 5% pay raise, and they were successful. Are Kentucky teachers emboldened by this national conversation happening right now?
I think certainly the West Virginia, quasi-strike emboldened some teachers here. But, you know, teachers have really been rallying around this issue here for a while now. And on this big final budget day, I think teachers saw an opportunity to show their force.
You mentioned many schools are on spring break this week. How are parents and kids responding to this? Are they unified with their teachers, or would they like to see them back in the classroom?
I think a lot of parents and students are. Certainly at these rallies, you see a lot of people besides teachers kind of showing some solidarity. And last week, you saw a lot of support when teachers took in mass a bunch of sick days on Friday after the pension changes were first made. But otherwise, it's a pretty teacher-led effort. And so far, this is one of the biggest rallies we've seen here in Frankfurt in at least a decade or two, possibly.
Hmm. Ryland Barton is a state capitol reporter for the Kentucky Public Radio Network at the state capitol there in Frankfurt. Ryland, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
So how are female supporters of President Trump responding to the recent allegations against him? Adult film star Stormy Daniels, Stephanie Clifford, wants the non-disclosure agreement Trump's lawyer had her sign nullified because the president didn't sign it. Last week, a judge temporarily stopped her request to depose the president about the one-night stand she says they had, and Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid her $130,000 to keep quiet. Then there's Karen McDougal, who says she had a 10-month-long affair with Donald Trump. Here she is speaking with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
I never brought up his wife. He did once, and that's the only time I can remember when he said she was an intelligent woman. She knew, four or five languages. But other than that, he never talked about his wife, and I never brought her up. Obviously, there's a reason I don't bring her up, because I felt guilty about it, out of sight, out of mind.
McDougal says the National Enquirer paid her for what she thought was a career-boosting coverage, but now she's suing the paper, alleging they did what's called a catch-and-kill, buying her silence in order to kill the story. Of course, female Trump supporters do not speak with one voice, but polls show many are sticking with him, as is Kim Dowdle of Birmingham, Alabama. Kim, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and the last time we spoke, you did not side with President Trump. He backed the Republican Roy Moore in the Alabama Senate race. You went with the Democrat Doug Jones, and you told us it's because you believe the women who accused Roy Moore of preying on them when they were teens, right?
I sure do.
Yeah.
My views on Stephanie Clifford and Karen differ greatly. Now, what he did with Karen was an affair. What he did with Stormy Daniels, Stephanie Clifford, is a one-night stand, and she's running on it.
But what I'm hearing is you believe the women.
Oh, yeah.
And yet you still support the president. How so?
Here's my opinion. There are many men that have been in high authority that have had extramarital affairs. And also, just because I support my president does not mean that I think he's a good man. I think he loves America. Let's get that straight. Look at JFK. Martin Luther King Jr. I love Martin Luther King Jr. He had an affair. And so why can I support my president and not support someone like Roy Moore? Mm. Let's go there. Not supporting Roy Moore is a big deal in this state. What I think Stormy Daniels is doing is a win for herself. What I think that Beverly and Lee did.
Moore's accusers.
Correct. Yeah. What I think they did was they chose to help solve the problem for America. My personal view is that I feel like Stormy Daniels is borderline treason.
So you're saying Moore's accusers, helped people see and avoid voting for a predator as a candidate, whereas Donald Trump is president right now, and you feel that that's treasonous to come out against the president.
Why did they not? Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, why did she not come out prior? If you really do your research, you're going to see that she's denied it five different times. I'm so sick and tired of people telling me that the people like Beverly and Lee came out as an opportunistic venture against Roy Moore. What they did was help solve a problem in America so that we didn't have another problem in Washington.
Are you saying then maybe that Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal should have come out before, which, by the way, they said they couldn't because they believed that they had these non-disclosure agreements and would be
if
sued?
They're,
and Stormy Daniels is saying now she's realizing that Trump didn't sign it.
If they were really worried, particularly Stormy, that would have been the time.
Hey, got to ask you, Kim, I'm wondering, too, it sounds like you're watching this, you know, almost like a Donald Trump reality show.
It's like that's what it's being made of, is like a reality show. And honestly, people are forgetting key people in this reality show. And they're Barron and Melania and Ivanka and Donald Jr. and Eric and all of them.
Is there nothing in this story that unsettles you about President Trump?
What unsettles me the most is the fact that the attention is being taken off of policy and put onto rhetoric. And there's so much wrong with this country. And there's so much right with this country. But no one can see the right and the wrong so that we can correct the first and emphasize the latter, because we're worried about what he's doing privately. I cannot even begin to fathom how different my life would be living in the South, and particularly in Birmingham, Alabama, if people had focused on Martin Luther King Jr.'s sexual behavior versus the words that came out of his mouth, the heart behind what he was trying to accomplish for all color. You know, people don't like President Trump because he's not polished. That's why we voted for him, everyone. Hello? He's got great policies. If we just stop and look at the policies, Roy Moore could be stopped before he began. Trump's in office right now, so you better figure out what he's about and not where he is in the bedroom.
That's Kim Dowdle of Birmingham, Alabama, a Trump supporter. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
You as well. Thank you. Have a great day.
And thoughts welcome here now.org. Now to Mount Everest, which a Nepali Sherpa is hoping to summit next month for the 22nd time, a record. But May is a busy and dangerous time for Sherpas who guide foreign climbers. So far, 94 Sherpas have died on Everest, about a third of the total lives lost there. In comparison, just 13 Americans have died. For NPR's Take a Number series, Danielle Price looks at why that is.
At Kathmandu's Rum Doodle Bar and Restaurant, the walls are lined with signatures of famous Everest summiters.
So this is Edmund Hillary, E.P. Hillary, 1953.
Chef Roj Albaidia points out the first people to summit, the late Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa climbing partner Tenzing Norgay, who died in 1986.
Tenzing Norgay, he doesn't know how to sign, so he's not literate. So we only have his picture over there.
Nearby are signatures of Apa Sherpa, Lakpa Gelu Sherpa, and Babu Chiri Sherpa, who have set records for the most number of summits, fastest summit, and most hours spent on the top. Sherpa is the name of the ethnic group that lives in much of the high Himalaya and often work on the mountain. These jobs have brought money and development to their communities, but little glory for the Sherpas. For the last 2 years, Sherpas haven't even received the certificates foreign climbers got to prove they reached the top. They're often viewed as just doing their job. It just happens to be one of the most dangerous jobs in the world.
There was four Sherpa die same time. My first expedition.
Forba Sherpa has stood on top of Everest 12 times as a porter and guide. Five of his brothers have summited too. On his first expedition, just west of Everest on Mount Pumori, one of the brothers died in an avalanche.
I give up. I promise. I never climb mountain. And I went in my belly. But 1 year I changed again my mind because I need money, you know.
Forba Sherpa earns $8,000 to $10,000 a year guiding on Everest, about 10 times what an average Nepali makes. He likes his job, but the work he does exposes him to the mountain's dangers much more than paying climbers. The most dangerous section is the Khumbu Icefall, where house-sized slabs of ice hang and sometimes break off. Most foreign climbers pass through the icefall 3 to 4 times. But Sherpas spend time doing the dirty work that makes a summit attempt possible, explains fellow climber Tashi Sherpa.
From food, oxygen, stands, and everything till to the camphor. So we have to go 15 to 20 times up and down.
Some of the mountain's bravest workers are called icefall doctors. They spend up to 16 hours a day in the icefall attaching ropes and ladders. 26-year-old Galjin Sherpa just retired from that job to the relative safety of climbing with clients.
This climbing also, I don't like this. I'm doing for my family, you know, because I don't have education. If we don't have education, we cannot get good job.
After 16 Sherpas died in the icefall in 2014, safety concerns grew, and so did demands for change. One idea the government floated is carrying some gear by helicopter to reduce trips. Helis have started doing more high-elevation rescues, too. Another solution is to climb from the safer northern face in Tibet. There's also a push for more technical training, which helps Sherpa climbers who often start on Everest because of strength and endurance, but without much training. American Jenny Lowe Anker started the Khumbu Climbing Center to teach safe mountaineering after her husband, Alex Lowe, died while climbing in Tibet. I reached her on Skype.
We had a number of those students who were already had summited on Everest, but none of them knew how to tie your basic safe knots.
But Sherpas aren't waiting for the government or outsiders to fix things. Some, like Forba Sherpa, are starting their own companies to earn more safely. Many, like Galjin Sherpa, are moving their families to Kathmandu for better opportunities. What comes after Tuesday? Galjin asks his 5-year-old son, Lakpa, who's doing homework in their room.
Tuesday.
Lakpa might grow up to be a climber like his dad, but Galjin says maybe he'll be a pilot, or a doctor, or an engineer. He wants to be sure his son has the choices he didn't have. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Price in Kathmandu.
The country's largest owner of television stations is under fire today for making dozens of news anchors read a scripted promo that echoes conservative rhetoric about bias in the media. A compilation of newscasters reading the script went viral over the weekend, courtesy of the website Deadspin.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media. More alarming.
Sinclair Broadcast Group owns or operates nearly 200 TV stations in the United States, and this morning, even President Trump jumped into the conversation to defend the company over this. Let's bring in Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, hi, how are you?
Okay, I'm well, thanks. Good to be here.
Good. So talk about this script that local anchors across the country, major cities, small towns, they were asked to read it. And in that compilation, we can really hear that journalists are basically using one of the president's favorite talking points.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. So Sinclair, as you said, is the largest television station owner in the U.S. It owns stations in about half of U.S. markets. The company has been known for a while as a giant of local television. But as listeners can probably tell, it's become infamous in the last few years for becoming a kind of mini Fox News, a media giant with an explicit rightward political bent. And I think Sinclair is so fascinating right now because it represents the confluence of two big modern storylines, an economic fear of monopoly power, of companies getting too big on the one hand, and on the other hand, a political slash media fear about truth and bias in the news. And what's captivating about Sinclair, and I think you can hear this right in that clip, is that, yes, there are larger media companies and there are lots of more conservative companies, but specifically this combination of such a large media company with such an explicitly conservative message that so often, as you said, mimics the president's language about fake news in that which most of us would call the mainstream media, I think has a lot of news watchers and individuals a little bit concerned about Sinclair's influence.
Well, and it's done this before in a way. It's got this must-run programming that it's known for. And some of that has included pro-Trump commentary from a former Trump campaign advisor. How independent are these local stations from the corporate owner?
It's hard to say. On the one hand, you often, with television station operators like this, have a certain amount of independence at the affiliate level. That is to say, St. Louis can determine what sort of news is important for the St. Louis audience, and Seattle can determine what sort of news is important for the Seattle audience, and, you know, ne'er the two shall meet. But with these must-run programming bits, the ones like the ones that you just heard, Sinclair essentially finds a way to dictate from its headquarters in and around Baltimore the kind of programming that Americans watching local news should hear all over the country. And these must-run programming bits typically do tilt to the right. These aren't bits that are the sort of thing that you might hear on, say, you know, ABC or CNN. They tend to be about terrorist updates. They tend to use the president's language about fake news and bias in mainstream news. Mm-hmm. So often it does seem like the sort of programming that you could almost expect Trump's communications team would hope would run across the country.
Well, let's listen to another clip from that Deadspin compilation.
And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
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 Okay, so you get the idea there. But Derek, some people might say that having local journalists push the agenda of their corporate bosses is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
It is certainly Orwellian, explicitly Orwellian, to hear all of these theoretically and seemingly independent newsreaders essentially read from a script that has been foisted on them. But, and CNN has reported a lot of anonymous people working at Sinclair-owned television stations around the country expressing quite a few concerns about the degree to which they feel like they are on a leash. I should say what's really important when listening to these messages is to think about the psychology of persuasion. There was a lot of fear about fake news on Facebook and Twitter about, propaganda being used to advance conspiracy theories. Yeah. But according to the research on the psychology of persuasion, people are most likely to change their minds when they hear new messages from familiar faces. And so what I think makes some people so nervous about Sinclair-operated television stations is that Sinclair can essentially co-opt newsreaders, anchors, reporters, that those local audiences think are independent, that they've come to trust, and then those reporters and journalists essentially become puppets of Sinclair's central broadcasting.
So, Derek,
and that, I think, is a real fear.
So very quickly, what would you expect the journalists to do in that situation?
In the short term, I expect they're going to do what they have done, which is to complain anonymously. They don't want to be fired. These journalists don't want to lose their jobs. They want to get a paycheck. But in the longer run, I do think that you could potentially see some journalists get together, you know, sign documents representing their lack of happiness and the fact that they're being centrally controlled.
Derek Thompson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.